You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Squatter of Point Doom by Bradley Hope and Tom Wright. By this time, according to L.A. court records, McNulty had been involved in at least four tenancy lawsuits. Some of the lawsuits are sealed, but at least one eviction case was dismissed by the judge. The law, it seemed, was in her favor. Gervitz contacted everyone he could find on her Facebook page and began collecting stories. In one, McNulty had allegedly stayed at her yoga teacher's house without paying rent. She didn't pay for classes either, it was claimed, but continued to show up for them all the same. When confronted, her bubbly persona would evaporate, Gervitz says. Although an eviction can take months in California, there are ways to speed up the process. One is to get a judge to issue a civil harassment restraining order, which allows the police to intervene. Even then, Gervitz was told, the LAPD is not permitted to forcibly remove a resident. Instead, they have to persuade the tenant to leave the home, at which point the landlord can lock the person out. That's what happened to McNulty. According to Gervitz, the police asked her to step outside to discuss the civil disobedience ruling he had secured. And once she came outside of her own volition, and she was basically with the officer, he wouldn't let her go back inside, Gervitz says. Enterprising adversaries like Gervitz are a headache. McNulty moved on to a widow in her 80s who was looking to rent out a room in her Santa Monica bungalow. It was a cute house with a small garden surrounded by trees and flowers. The details of the lawsuit the widow brought against McNulty in 2016 are sealed. According to a source with knowledge of the situation, the widow was so emotionally distraught by the ongoing legal fight that she agreed to pay McNulty tens of thousands of dollars to leave her house. By then, it's possible Los Angeles, the scene of so many legal battles, was losing its luster for McNulty. Or maybe she wanted to move to even nicer surroundings. Whatever her motivations, McNulty, like many wealthy Angelenos who tire of the city, set a course for Point Doom. After her brother's breakdown, Mindy Moran began to search legal records involving McNulty. She says she was surprised to find more than 10 cases stretching back almost two decades. The most recent were all in the Point Doom area. One of them involved Roger and Natasha Honan, who decided to rent a room attached to their garage in late 2019 after Roger lost his job. The Honans found McNulty on a Facebook group that connects would-be tenants and landlords in the area. Natasha says McNulty identified herself as an English actor and said her house had burned down in the fires earlier that year. Slowly, the penny dropped in about 2 days that something's not quite right with this girl, Natasha says. McNulty, she adds, made elaborate excuses for not making rent and sulked when Natasha refused to lend her a family car. Some of McNulty's behavior was just plain weird, according to Natasha. One day, she looked in on the apartment and saw a three-foot-high pile of torn paper in the center of the room. Her behavior inside the main house was even more unnerving. She'd come into the kitchen while I was cooking and creep up right behind me, Natasha says. Sometimes, late at night, they'd hear McNulty tiptoeing onto their floor to do laundry. To protect themselves, they placed an old cowbell on the door from her apartment to the house, but she soon figured out how to enter without making a sound. One night, McNulty slammed a door and ran away after Natasha demanded the rent, she says. That's when Natasha began digging online and found evidence that McNulty had been wrangling in court with landlords since before she moved to L.A. I realized that she had started doing it when she first landed in New York City. 20 years ago, Natasha says, she's been doing this her whole life. Ironically, it was the pandemic that gave the Honans the opening they needed to successfully evict McNulty. Their daughter had health problems, and McNulty's refusal to get vaccinated was putting her at risk. Meanwhile, employees at Point Doom Village began to take note of McNulty. Staff at Le Café de la Plage and the town's high-end shops came to know her as an eccentric who walked her cats on leashes on the private beaches. She would order coffees and then ask others to pay, or simply make no attempt to pay at all. McNulty often posted about how much she loved the land around Point Doom and how blessed she was to live in such surroundings. She dreamed of getting back to the success she'd enjoyed in 1990s New York. Amarjit Singh Marwa, a 98-year-old retired dentist whose patients once included Gregory Peck and Elizabeth Taylor, lives in a mansion in the hills behind Point Doom. He says McNulty turned up at his door one day and asked permission to set up an art fair on his lawn. He agreed, but the art didn't sell. Eventually, Marwa says he gave her a few $1,000s, money he considered a charity donation. Later, McNulty moved in with another family who rented a bedroom in their house to her in 2021. She refused to pay and stayed there for months, a family member says, leaving only when the sheriff forcibly evicted her. That's when she encountered Alden Marin on the Point Doom beach. After Alden was allegedly locked out of his apartment, Mindy vowed to fight McNulty in court. At one point, she says, McNulty offered through an intermediary to leave if she were paid $20,000. She figures out you hate her so much. You're afraid of her. You want to get rid of her. You don't want to go to court. You don't want those months of your life tormented, torture, and everything she knows she's subjecting you to. So she'll hope you're going to pay just to get her out, she says. This time, though, McNulty's gambit didn't work. She knew that Alden had the backing of me, who was unrelenting, and his brother, and that she was going to see us in court. And she knew that we had a pretty good case, Mindy says. McNulty had also made a misstep. She'd asked for the $20,000 from the Marins as a way to pay a deposit on her next place, a property just east of Point Doom near Barbara Streisand's mansion, according to Mindy. She'd provided the banking details of the owner, a retired schoolteacher. And the agreement is she's got her next grift lined up, like the poor schoolteacher that we unearthed, because she was stupid enough to give me the bank information because she was starting to panic, Mindy says. Instead of paying her to vacate Alden's place, Mindy decided to pass a warning to the prospective landlord about McNulty. She never moved in. In early 2022, the Marins went to court in Los Angeles. Alden was shaking in his boots, his sister says. At one point, according to Mindy, McNulty stepped into an elevator with them and proceeded to pursue the family around the courthouse. She tried to follow us through the stairwells on different floors. We had to wait in a parking garage, she says. It was nuts. Eventually, a judge ordered McNulty to vacate the premises. They threw the book at her, Mindy says. But somehow she must be staying somewhere right now. For all we know, she's got a new victim. By the end of last year, McNulty's whereabouts were unknown. She'd been spotted a few times in Point Doom's shopping center. A manager at Le Café de la Plage Malibu said she'd been banned for harassing customers for free coffee. A security guard for the shopping complex said he'd been told to keep an eye on her. She was making fewer appearances at the cafe or the nearby Pavilion supermarket, and she wasn't seen much on the beaches either. And so we sent her a text. "Hi, is this Ellie?" "Hi, yes, this is Ellie," came the reply. "Please could you remind me where, how we met?" At first she was cordial, sensing, perhaps, that there was something to gain from the interaction. But after it became clear she was the subject of an investigative report about her disputes with landlords, McNulty obfuscated. She declined to meet or answer questions. Eventually, she wrote, "We don't retaliate, and we don't denounce anyone, so I'll let the sweet truth triumph in the end. Thank you." Later, we sent a detailed list of questions. She never responded. One day in November 2023, just as it was finally starting to turn cold in Point Doom, McNulty reappeared on the doorstep of Marwa, the retired dentist to the stars, asking for more money. Marwa says he declined and told her not to come back. Lately, she's been posting photographs from Escondido Beach, just east of Point Doom. As for Alden, he was discharged from the hospital and moved to a new place because he didn't feel safe in the old condo. He was terrified of her after she left, Mindy says. He would see her all the time, and it was awful for him. After bumping into McNulty one too many times around town and on the beach, Alden finally moved out of Malibu and allowed his family to sell the condo. But life is not the same. He's just not himself. And any of his friends would tell you that. Like, oh my God, what happened to Alden? the Mary Poppins of Mulholland Drive. When I was 9, Lara Flynn Boyle was my father's sweetheart and my best friend, by Lorraine Nicholson. For many girls, best friends are their first loves. They spend all their time together, learn from each other, protect each other. And when the time comes for boys to enter the picture, and a best friend's attention is split between them and another, it is their first great heartbreak. When I was 9, my best friend was 30-year-old ingenue Lara Flynn Boyle. The world fell in love with Lara long before I did. A lead actor on the cult TV show Twin Peaks, she burst onto the scene as America's good girl in Angora. From the very first, she was determined to buck this image. In a 1990 cover story for Rolling Stone, the journalist seems taken aback by Lara, then just 20. The actress smokes heavily and is game and playful. The character has no questionable habits, besides crying frequently, and is somber and conflicted. Lara, an Irish girl from Iowa, represented everything that America could be at its best: tough, beautiful, dangerous. Much like the universe, Lara's romance with my father began with a bang. One quiet summer night in 1999, the nascent couple was dressed for dinner, the engine of his Mercedes the only sound. My father moved to make a left on Mulholland from Coldwater, just a quarter mile from our house, when their car collided with another. When Dad finally came to, head dripping blood, he looked up to see Lara crawling out of the sunroof. She reportedly screamed, "I can't be here," and abandoned the steaming hunk of metal like it was a dead horse. I first heard about the crash not from any members of my family, but from a nosy mother at school. This was confusing. I'd seen my dad just a few days previously, and he didn't mention a car accident. Not knowing the news would be picked up by the tabloids, he wanted to introduce Lara on his own terms. Their union was presented as something to be ashamed of, inspiring the kind of tisk-tisk condemnation that belies the thrill of imagining such a life. People who were interested in my dad and Lara, like the mother at school, were interested in them not just because they were dangerous and intelligent, but also because by reading about them, they felt dangerous and intelligent too. The spectacle of the relationship between Jack Nicholson and this Twin Peaks star, 33 years his junior, was so scandalous, no one could see they were actually falling in love. The family Lara walked into was actually kind of typical. In our house, we lived more by the motto, "Children are to be seen, not heard," than any hippie California ethos. And yet, this was the marvelous world of Jack Nicholson. We would drive golf balls into the canyons. We'd eat dinner after 9 p.m. And though we never saw him, my brother and I lived in constant terror of our reclusive neighbor Marlon Brando, who could come lumbering down our shared driveway in search of ice cream at any moment, trailed by his pair of snapping black English mastiffs. In other words, like the Banks family of Mary Poppins fame, we were primed for the arrival of magic. I'll never forget the first day Lara was introduced to us children. She came down the outdoor staircase to join us by the pool. I remember the sun reflecting on the water, the sound of wind chimes in the trees. Most importantly, I remember what Lara wore, a thong bathing suit with flames licking up the crotch. We didn't have to know she had been nominated for an Emmy that year for her work on The Practice for my brother and I to know we were in the presence of a powerful person. That day, I was too afraid to speak to her. Instead, I watched her surreptitiously from the shallow end, as she read a book on a plastic raft, the wind gently pushing her back and forth across the surface of the water. Finally, she had arrived, the answer to my prayers, the Mary Poppins of Mulholland Drive. At that point in my life, I yearned for the entrance of such a character. My mother had a new boyfriend, putting the final nail in the coffin of her relationship with my father. That coffin was almost comedic to imagine, a coffin so heavy with nails it sank deeper and deeper toward the core of the earth. While I knew her separation from my father had nothing to do with us children, I couldn't help but feel superfluous in her life. Her boyfriend was young like she was, and already successful in the brave new world of tech. Alex came with his own coterie of young men, including a pair of blonde twins, and the former junkie, future Oscar winner Steve Gaggin. In my memory, my mother had a drum kit set up in our living room for most of my childhood. Whether this is true or not suggests a larger theme. My mother's house was loud and full of the kind of play that's appropriate mostly for adults. My father's house was the precise opposite. Up on Mulholland, we lived among an almost mausoleum-level quiet. By his own admission, my dad had a hard time connecting to us as children. Though he loved beautiful women, he had no interest in playing with dolls. Lara, on the other hand, was happy to play with me. After I received a treasure trove of Barbies on Christmas one year, Lara joined me on the carpet to play. When I looked over at her a few minutes later, I was shocked to find she was smashing the dolls' faces together. My Barbies were kissing. "What are you doing?" I asked. "You have no kins. They're lonely," she explained. In me, Lara found a little girl who hated herself before puberty even. My mother could never understand it, because my mother was beautiful. I would not be surprised to learn my mother's Kentucky-bred curves caused car accidents in Beverly Hills. Her face was innocent, yet at the same time inviting. She had wide-set eyes and the puffy kind of lips women in the 21st century pay for. It's natural for a teenage girl to feel some level of antagonism toward her mother, but having to look at her every day felt like a personal attack. Lara was also beautiful, but she suffered from the same perceived physical shortcomings I did. She was flat-chested and covered with freckles. I have now read every article on her that I can find for the purpose of this piece, and almost every one mentions these facts. As someone who spent so many nights praying to be different, I was amazed to watch Lara lean into her physicality, daring the already predatory paparazzi and press to criticize her, which inevitably they did. Lara ordered wildly caloric meals during interviews. On the red carpet, she wore handkerchief-like dresses that accentuated every sharp angle of her body. Paparazzi photos of Lara at the beach in a bikini had more impact on me than the Zapruder film I had watched that year in history class. It was like Mary Poppins teaching the Banks children to slide up the railing instead of down. Let them look. The point is, Lara was free, and I was not. As a gangly Irish-American herself, she knew the pain of being an ugly girl. She had experiences my mother never had. Like the time she told me she would create boobs in her bikini top with toilet paper, only to forget, wade into water, and watch the matted, snot-like ephemera float away in the current. With extrasensory intuition, she sensed I was a self-harmer and told me stories about the time she had to wear knee socks to hide her scratched-up shins. Lara made me feel like my pain mattered. In interviews from the period, Lara explained that her father abandoned her when she was 6 years old. Her mother had to work three jobs and enlisted Lara to help pick up the bodies of the dead rodents in a building where she worked. While the unavailability of my parents was not exactly rats in trash bags level, I was a kid who felt, despite everything I had materially, there was something missing in my life. Lara did not belittle these feelings. She told all these stories with a cigarette and a smile because she was a survivor. Before Lara entered my life, my favorite summer activity was going to Staples to buy pencil cases and binders before school started in the fall. Lara taught me that much like femininity, adolescence can be depressing and confusing, but it can also be full of freedom and unencumbered play. As my life started to change, so too did the world. America was at war. Civil liberties were under attack. Against the backdrop of approaching darkness, Lara taught me the glory of loving every day. In the photos, and Lara Flynn Boyle, Lorraine Nicholson found a role model and a kindred spirit. The author and her father, Jack Nicholson, circa 2000. Though she and my father weren't married, I grabbed onto Lara like she was made of glue. At a time in Los Angeles when people of all ages dressed like pop stars, Lara let me wear her low-rise jeans. She introduced me to the founder of my favorite brand, Juicy Couture. On our trips to Aspen, I was relegated to the worst room of all, which only had a bunk bed for sleeping. On nights when I was tortured with terrors, it was Lara who would take the top bunk, despite its being perilously close to the ceiling. For my father, Lara acted as a bridge between him and his children. Suddenly, we were doing things we had never done before. In Aspen, we went whitewater rafting down the Colorado River. We cackled wildly while playing Parcheesi. In one particularly traitorous game of Uno, my brother and I kamikazed ourselves so that while we wouldn't win, my father wouldn't either. After he stormed out of the room, followed by a trail of very Nicholson obscenities, it was Lara who put a stop to his sulking and lured him back upstairs. Since his relationship with my mom, I had never seen my father with another woman. Like in the Mary Poppins films, I understand why it was Lara who sent the other applicants blowing ass over heels down the street. Yet dark forces were closing in. For months, Lara would show up giddy at the dinner table, armed with stories from the set of Men in Black 2, where she was playing an alien in the body of a Victoria's Secret model. To create boobs, she joked to me, they had to squeeze fat from as far as her ankles. Her costume was so tight, she couldn't pee without help. And yet, when the time came to actually see the film, even 12-year-old me could see this part was a pale facsimile of the public persona Lara had created for herself. Compared to Vincent D'Onofrio's choking, sugar-obsessed antagonist of the original, Lara's dominatrix, quips, and whip-like tentacles felt stale. This movie star turn, which was supposed to elevate Lara, ended up diminishing her instead. Meanwhile, Lara did nothing to help herself with jokes to the press like, "I'm the kind of woman who, when she walks into a party, all the other women leave." And I'm high maintenance, and I'm worth it. As one journalist vividly wrote, chatting with Boyle is like feeding a roll of quarters into a jukebox full of songs about naughty girls. The public's attitude toward Lara became increasingly ambivalent. As much as they wanted to raise her up, they wanted to tear her down. Look no further than an article that appeared in Us magazine titled, "The Actress Women Love to Hate," which detailed reasons both to hate Lara, skeletal body, big ego, and on the next page, almost as an afterthought, reasons to love her, childhood trauma, close relationship with her mom. Lara's relationship with my father was a point of no return, in which she went from being a woman on the verge of stardom, a person validated for her work, to a mere celebrity. The media had an overwhelming hunger for all things Lara, but most of all for signs that she was sick or insane. People wanted proof that her unapologetically bohemian bad girl lifestyle was unsustainable and damaging. The public became so infatuated with Lara that, like the Eucharist, they swallowed her whole. In my fantasy version of this story, Lara leaves our family because she knows I got what I needed. It was around this time that my mother's battle with alcohol reached its Jerry Springer heights. A plane bound for London had to make an emergency landing after Mom punched a flight attendant in the face. Lara, as Mary Poppins, knows that an incident so embarrassing, so public, would jumpstart my mother's recovery. My father would be forced to take action. And in this one sense, fictional Lara was right. This episode marked a new phase in my relationship with my dad. Though I was just 12, he could speak to me like an adult. We could now become best friends. And so, with a knowing smile and a wink, Lara opens her magical umbrella and disappears into the sky. In reality, I have no clue why my father and Lara broke up. I don't know if he cried or if she cried, but I certainly did. I woke one snowy winter morning at our house in Aspen, and she had just vanished. While I never saw her again, and she did leave behind a few things, a crusty bottle of vanilla-scented lotion, a high-quality white negligee, and a box of tampons, which I used the first time I got my period, too embarrassed to admit to my now single father that I had started menstruating, which, needless to say, led to more crying. I'd known my father's relationship with Lara couldn't last forever, and yet when I was with her, I had no clue what I would do without her. But once she actually left, and this points to the resilience of children, life went on. After all, when it's time for Mary Poppins to go, even the Banks children run out of the house to fly a kite with their father without so much as a goodbye or a thank you. I imagine it cannot be easy falling for a man with children. On the one hand, they feel like unwanted appendages. On the other, you fall in love with them a little bit, too. Next photos. The author was too nervous to speak with Boyle when they first met at the Nicholson's pool. Boyle and Nicholson walk arm in arm at the Moscow International Film Festival in 2001. Boyle, looking like a Degas painting at the 2003 Golden Globe Awards. A few months after she disappeared from our lives for good, Lara showed up at the Golden Globes in a tutu. She met the incredulous glances of the press, the cruelty of her peers, with a smile. Even Joan Rivers had to admit, "You have such guts." Compared to red carpet appearances today, which are meticulously curated by a cadre of stylists, Lara's outfit is startlingly original. For the treachery of authenticity, Lara was universally condemned, not just as the worst dressed, but potentially insane. Seeing her torn apart by the press was like seeing a part of myself, the part that's chaotic, unpredictable, and free, torn apart too. I read that my father, on the other hand, reacted to Lara's red carpet appearance with three words, "Isn't she great?" While I can't say for sure if this is how he felt, the quote certainly sounds like him. My dad belonged to a school of thought that elevated counterculture figures like Hunter Thompson or Holden Caulfield. Lara refused to be transformed into the right kind of celebrity, thumbing her nose at an increasingly corporatized, cynical world. My father presented an idea that at that time I could not understand, that being a sicko in a sick world may indeed be great. After 2003, Lara slowly disappeared from films and television. Like Rick Dalton and Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in the parts she did land, Lara was used primarily as a punching bag. She played a cruel prostitute in Life is Hot in Crackdown and a cruel boss in Baby on Board. Most climactically, her 8-episode arc as a casino owner on Las Vegas ends with her literally taking a flying leap. Lara, as Monica Mancuso, is blown off the roof of her own hotel, flying through the CGI skies to the witch's theme from The Wizard of Oz, until she smashes into a storefront and dies. Though her work in Hollywood all but dried up, she remained a fixture in the tabloids. Unflattering photographs of her taking out the trash and drinking in her car would continue to surface for the next 20 years. Yet Lara refused to descend into self-pity. As she recently told People magazine, "Any moment I was feeling down or sorry for myself, I made sure I did not complain. My mom used to sometimes bring me articles about other actresses to show me I'm not the only one getting a raw deal." Actresses in Lara's generation had to put up with the press diagnosing, based on paparazzi photos alone, the status of their mental health. Now a new generation of women has emerged to feel emboldened not only to acknowledge their struggles, but to share them with the world. As a result of this cultural shift, Lara is embraced by a new era of self-proclaimed crazy girls, the type of woman who posts and likes pictures of Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan. Without leaving the safety of our lives, we embrace their misfit status as a way of vicariously participating in it. Like my father before her, Lara has come to represent the potential for rebellion we all contain within ourselves. For this article, I ask Lara if I could see her for the first time in more than 20 years to talk about the time we shared. She declined. Of course, this feels like being rejected by Mommy. But the truth is, whether I see Lara again or not is almost irrelevant, because I carry so much of her in me. When she descended from the sky with her magic carpet bag, I was still figuring out the type of woman I wanted to be. In Lara, I saw characteristics that I liked: her irreverent sense of humor, her refusal to conform, her compassion for the underdog, and made them my own. Or to quote the last words Lara ever said to me, "I'll always have you in my heart, baby." a killer view. When an heiress to the L.L. Bean fortune noticed that a grove of majestic oaks on her coastal Maine property had died, she cast her suspicions on her neighbors uphill, summer residents who wanted a better view of Camden Harbor. The legal fight that ensued became a town drama that roils to this day, by Keziah Weir. Opening photos, an aerial view of Lisa Gorman's house in the foreground and Amelia and Arthur Bond's house behind it, divided by a stand of dead trees. Knox County, Camden, Maine. In summer, beech roses tumble over dry stone walls, and the long lupine spines streak roadsides and garden beds with purple. On certain winter days, when the temperature's right, sea smoke, a vaporous, ghostly fog, rises from the harbor. The craggy face of Mount Batty looms to the north. On the cover of Camden's 2024 annual report, available for passers-by at the town office, the town slogan, "Where the mountains meet the sea." For visitors, Camden might be a stop along U.S. Route 1, called the Coastal Highway, though it only briefly kisses the water. What the drive on U.S. Route 1 lacks in actual coastline, it makes up for in dense stretches of trees, various rock and mineral shops, excellent thrift stores, and the Taste of Maine restaurant, almost impossible to miss, given that the world's largest inflatable lobster, a 700-pound behemoth named Larry, sprawls across its roof. Once you see Larry, you're about an hour out. In Camden, you'll find a town of tidy colonials and Cape Cods and bungalow cottages with names like Shamrocks and Millstones. After a fire decimated 40 buildings on the main drag during the shipbuilding boom back in 1892, business owners got together and decided to remake the district in brick, rendering it more fire-resistant and perfectly picturesque. When it came time to choose a filming location for 1957's Peyton Place, a story of gossip and violence roiling against a backdrop of New England charm, the filmmakers chose Camden. Today, thanks in part to a local ordinance, even the Walgreens sign is quaint. Its logo rendered not in the usual oversized red plastic, but instead in a tasteful, unassuming gold on black. The population is just above 5,000, and there are a little more than three times as many registered Democrats as there are Republicans. For the 2020 census, 93% of residents are white. It's a year-round town. Locals will be quick to tell you, not like Bar Harbor. Most of the businesses stay open for the winter, kept afloat by full-time residents and visitors to the Camden Snow Bowl, which houses a 400-foot wooden chute that allows many toboggans to reach speeds up to 40 miles per hour, according to the website, and, more notably, in a town that prizes the expanse of its harbor above much else, it is also the only ski area on the East Coast with ocean views. Less than a mile from the town center, Lisa Gorman's two-story cedar-shingled vacation home nestles on a low bluff above the Atlantic, with floor-to-ceiling windows offering an unobstructed panorama of Camden Harbor and a set of private steps winding down to a public beach. Native oaks, spruces, and hemlocks encircle the property at 3 Metcalf Road, which covers a little over half an acre and abuts two neighboring plots. It's a prime spot in a rarefied neighborhood, one befitting the 74-year-old widow of the chairman emeritus of L.L. Bean. The town's median income is about $91,000, and its median home price hovers around $800,000. Down the street from Gorman, a 5-bedroom waterfront property is listed for just shy of $4.5 million, and her own home is valued at $5 million. Her neighbors include John Reed, the former CEO of Citigroup, and chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, and at least one heir to the IBM Watson fortune. Sometime in the spring of 2022, a caretaker noticed that several of the trees on Gorman's property were ailing. Leaves withered, turning yellow and brown. The failing trees were along the property line that divided Gorman's house from her uphill neighbors at 1 Metcalf Road, Amelia and Arthur Bond, both in their mid-60s. In May, Gorman's landscapers arrived to suss out the scene. The crew found themselves working in close proximity to another team of landscapers. Not unusual in a town where gardening, as one local said, is blood sport, contracted by the Bonds. The unusual thing was that, according to a document written by Gorman's lawyer and sent to the town of Camden, her guys found the Bonds guys putting ladders on Gorman's trees, as if they were preparing to cut them down. Gorman's team ran them off, but shortly thereafter, Gorman noticed that more than a dozen appeared to be missing their tops. In mid-June, according to the same document, Amelia Bond told Gorman that her trees did not look good. There was apparently some mention of brown-tail moths, seasonal pest, that had become a particular nuisance in Camden in recent years. The caterpillars have tiny noxious hairs that can cause a poison ivy-esque rash and feed on oaks like the ones languishing on Gorman's property. Amelia Bond made a neighborly suggestion that she and Gorman split the cost of removing the trees. But Gorman had been treating her trees for brown-tail moths, and her landscapers thought the damage looked more like a symptom of herbicide. It so happened that the trees featured prominently in the view from the Bond's bay-facing windows. Gorman declined the unbelievably generous offer. Instead, in July, Gorman contracted Bartlett tree experts to take tissue samples. The samples came back positive for tebutherion, a broad-spectrum herbicide indicated to kill woody and herbaceous plants at industrial and large-scale sites like airports, highways, and grazing pastures. On Gorman's property, the herbicide had seemingly affected more than 80 trees, bushes, and shrubs. Maples, blueberry bushes, dogwoods, and seven mature oaks that towered over the houses, ranging from 39 to 77 feet high. The flora was unsalvageable and would need to be removed. And because of the nature of the herbicide, which is resistant to degradation and disperses via groundwater, the soil would have to go too. In October, Gorman's lawyer, Daniel Nutzi, contacted the office of Camden's Planning and Development Director, Jeremy Martin. "Hey, can you meet me on the site?" Martin remembers the lawyer saying. "We got a problem." Martin, who among other things oversees the town's shoreland zoning, visited the site, took a look at the affected trees, and in turn brought the issue to the Camden Select Board. And just like that, the neighborly dispute became a matter of public record, spiraling into a saga that has dredged up existential anxieties and disparate personal tragedies, and that now, more than 2 years later, remains unresolved. Camden operates under a select board town manager form of government. The last holdout in the experiment of direct democracy that began in New England nearly 400 years ago, as current board member Allison McKellar wrote in her first campaign letter, published in the local outlet The Penobscot Bay Pilot in 2017. An elected 5-member select board serves as the executive branch, while a board-appointed town manager handles daily administrative duties. At the state and federal level, we have a republic, not a democracy, and this is the system we teach in schools, she wrote. Not so in Camden. The select board gets to choose a town manager, but citizens must vote on budgets, ordinances, and many contracts and policies that the town adopts. 7 years into her tenure, she adds to me, we're very much a complaint-based system. McKellar, born and raised in town, is 40 years old, with the streaked blonde hair of a camp counselor and a wry sense of humor. Brown tail moths or no, you can't decide to put your neighbor's trees out of their misery, she said with droll exasperation during one select board meeting, by poisoning them. Her longtime cause celeb has been lobbying for the demolition of the town's controversial 200-year-old Montgomery Dam, an attractive relic that, following a 2021 study, environmental consultants advised should be removed. Her Instagram offers views of Camden typically reserved for the fish and the birds, drone shots of the harbor, underwater videos of trout and elvers in the McGuntacook River. In the name of participatory democracy, every 2 weeks, McKellar spends up to 4 hours in the bowels of the Camden Opera House, which homes the town office, with her fellow board members and the town manager, discussing and codifying issues ranging from marijuana licensing ordinances to solid waste disposal in town and the potential purchase of a new groomer for the Snowball. For their trouble, board members make $2,000 a year. It was Gorman's complaint to Martin's office, McKellar says, that triggered the select board's involvement in the herbiciding. If you're going to take somebody to court, you can send a notice of violation without the select board, but if you want to follow up, namely with enforcement action, they need us. Martin fields grievances about anything under the sun, he says, with not a little weariness when I meet him at the town office. Their tree, their vegetation, their drainage from their property is causing a problem on my property, is how he describes the scope. More often than not, he determines these to be civil matters rather than code violations. But following his visit to the site of the poisoning, Martin consulted with a Maine Department of Environmental Protection shoreland zoning coordinator on the relevant ordinance. It deals with aesthetics, erosion, water quality, those kinds of things, he says. And allegedly applying the herbicide that killed the trees, Amelia Bond had breached an ordinance, a fact Martin delivered on November 28, 2022, via a letter emblazoned with the town seal and notice of violation in large type. It came to the attention of the Camden Code and Planning Office that an herbicide was used by you or an agent of yours to defoliate and kill numerous woody trees and plants on land not owned by you at 3 Metcalf Road, Martin wrote. The town of Camden is alarmed at such blatant disregard for the environment and for the abutters' property, and in such close proximity to the Atlantic Ocean. Martin gave a copy of the letter to the select board, which kicked off the first of multiple discussions. The board, whose members serve staggered 3-year terms, can be a place for fierce disagreement. But on the herbicide, board member Tom Hedstrom tells me that the issue prompted the most unifying response that we've ever had. The premeditation is really shocking, because people make mistakes, right? Says Hedstrom, an electrician, and when we speak, first-term chairman of the Camden Select Board, which makes him as close to a mayor as an elected official in Camden's government can get. But this was the tale that was told, and it's not really in dispute, is that the Bonds went and put this poison on the Gorman's trees on their property, and then 6 months or a year later, when these mature oaks, and oaks are rugged, you have to really put something on, Roundup isn't going to kill an oak, when the trees started to die, they called up Ms. Gorman, and they asked her for a meeting, and they went out there and they said, boy, these trees really look rough, you really ought to cut them down. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.